coming up on this week's mini episode of the Drew Perowit Podcast.
You know, all of my life, I've put a lot of pressure on myself. And I think all of us, you know, we wear our hard work and our burnout as a badge of honor. And I was there. I was not sleeping. I was working crazy hours. I would come home, I'd spend time with the kids, and then I would study late at night. And there was just no time for, you know, any of the things that I enjoyed doing, because that would be, you know, lazy.
Hi, everyone. It's Drew. There's a reason I've talked to so many experts on my podcast about magnesium. This super mineral is needed for over 400 enzymatic reactions in your body. In fact, every single cell contains it and needs it to function. Magnesium is essential for stress management and restful sleep because of its influence on neurotransmitters. It supports insulin sensitivity and fights the risk of type 2 diabetes. And magnesium also reduces C-reactive protein and many other markers of inflammation, among so many other crucial functions. I personally started taking magnesium to help with my sleep, especially when I travel, which we're all starting to do again, and it's been a game changer. But I don't just take any old magnesium. I take Bio-Optimizer's Magnesium Breakthrough. It contains seven different forms of magnesium, which all have different functions in the body. I haven't found anything else like it on the market. That's why I hand it to all my friends like candy. Bio-Optimizer's is great because all their products are soy-free, gluten-free, lactose-free, non-GMO, free of chemicals and fillers, and made with all natural ingredients. Right now, Bio-Optimizers is offering my community a few special bundles. Just head over to magbreakthrough.com/Drew, spelled differently, D-H-R-U, with the code DREW10, D-H-R-U-10. So that's magbreakthrough, magbreakthrough.com/DHRU with the code DREW10. Have you ever gone to your doctor for your normal annual physical, and after sitting with them for 10 minutes, they quickly look at your labs and tell you, hey, everything looks normal. Keep it up and I'll see you again next year. Maybe even give you a nice little pat on the back. I can't tell you how many listeners of the podcast have told me that they've had this exact experience, and how honestly, how frustrating it can be. Now, we all know that normal isn't always optimal. Just because something's not wrong doesn't mean that we feel great. So traditional medicine is great at finding out when something is blatantly wrong, but they don't always do the best job when we need to highlight how we can do better. So what if you could get detailed nutritional and lifestyle guidance based on your individual needs? That's what Inside Tracker does. Inside Tracker was founded in 2009 by top scientists from acclaimed universities in the field of aging, genetics, and biometrics. Its mission is to help people live long, healthy, productive lives by optimizing their bodies from the inside out. Inside Tracker is cutting-edge technology, and it looks at your blood, DNA, lifestyle, and it has fitness tracker data, and they give you science-backed recommendations for positive changes to your daily habits. It's all about the daily habits. With their app, you can track your progress every day, and they have an amazing support team to help you with any questions you might have. Inside Tracker looks at everything from metabolic and inflammatory markers to top nutrients and hormones. It even tests your cholesterol levels to help you better manage stress. And you have the option to see how your inner age compares to your chronological age. Traditional lab tests can be hard to read on your own, but Inside Tracker makes their results easy to understand and even provides tips on how to use food first for optimal nutrition. Right now, Inside Tracker is offering my podcast community 25% off their system. Just go to insidetracker.com/Drew. That's DHRU to get your discount code and try it out for yourself. That's Inside Tracker, I-N-S-I-D-E, Tracker, TRACKER.com/Drew, DHRU for your 25% off. Hi everyone, Drew Perowit here. Does it feel like your life is too busy? Your days are too short and you're feeling overworked, overstressed, and overtired, chances are you've asked your doctor for help only to be told it's because of your age, or everyone's overloaded, or everyone's overworked, or worse, it's just normal. If so, you're not alone. In today's mini episode, I speak with Dr. Zandra Palma and Dr. Amy Shah about the HPA axis dysfunction, which is commonly referred to as adrenal fatigue. We talk about the causes and symptoms, what happens when our stress response system is always on, and what the first steps are to take when getting to the root of HPA axis dysfunction. Let's listen in, starting with my interview with Dr. Zandra Palma, a functional medicine physician with a background in internal medicine and anesthesiology. What are some things that people might be experiencing in their lives or could have gone through that could relate to this HPA dysfunction?
Yeah. Okay. So HPA dysfunction, we think of coming from four main factors. Perceived stress is one of the biggest ones. And this differs greatly from the reason that the system evolved in pre-human organisms, because it evolved to deal with mostly physiological immediate threats to the body. So, you know, the organisms that first evolved this evolved it, let's say you are a gazelle and you're being chased by a tiger, and the tiger's kind of gotten you, but you've sort of gotten away, but you're bleeding, you know, you're a little bit mauled, you need to get home, you've got a baby gazelle at home. That's what this system evolved for. Or it evolved for the tiger who hasn't eaten in 3 weeks and needs to catch this gazelle and feed his family. So that's what the system evolved for. It evolved to immediately turn on responses that will help us run, that'll help us hunt, that'll help us think. What it did not evolve for was for us to think, what if I get attacked by a tiger tomorrow? It didn't evolve for, you know, our cognitive worrying minds to kind of create these stressors without an actual physical threat. So now we define stress as a threat, real or implied, to the physiological or psychological stress, homeostasis of the individual, or the physical or psychological well-being of the individual. You know, so even thoughts now are stressors. So perceived stress is a big part of what causes dysfunction in this adrenal to brain loop. The other three are more physiologically based. So the other three are dysregulation of blood sugar. So spikes and troughs in blood sugar, kind of what you see with people who are on their way to developing diabetes or have diabetes. Another one is circadian disruption. So just your brain having a wacky time of whether it's day or night. And that happens mostly because of light exposure. Just living in cities, living with devices, having overhead lights, you know, not waking and going to bed with the sun. And the last one is inflammation, which is a giant category and the basis of, you know, all chronic disease. So inflammation causes HPA dysregulation as well.
So those are some things that can cause or an effect HPA dysfunction. But for the person who has it, who may not be familiar with that term, okay, HPA dysfunction, all right, I'm hearing about it for the first time. What are some symptoms that they're going through when that system is at dysfunction? What could be some diseases out there, or what could be some symptoms that people are going through on a daily basis that could be linked back to that?
Yeah, so we can talk about it in different body systems. So the brain is classic. In the brain, we see depression, anxiety, PTSD, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, which is sort of neurological and body. In the digestive system, we see IBS. We see dysbiosis, which is imbalance of good and bad bacteria. Metabolically, we see heart disease. We see cardiometabolic disease. We see obesity, diabetes. When we think about the reproductive organs, we see infertility. We see menstrual irregularities. We see low testosterone. We see PCOS. And the list goes on if you go through different body systems, but I think those are the big ones.
Pretty much everything and anything.
Yeah.
Can be connected back to this HPA axis.
It can be connected
back. Which is why
it's
so central and so important, and especially if you've never heard of this topic before, it's really important to get a handle on it and get an understanding on it, because it plays into every aspect of our health.
Yeah. It plays into every aspect of our health, and it actually actively, you know, we're talking about broken brain, it actually actively remodels the brain. And that's not always something that can be reversed.
So what happens to our stress response system when it's always on? Because you're talking about this feedback loop mm-hmm. being broken, in a sense of it's constantly in a state of worried, mm-hmm. whether real or perceived. The tiger tomorrow often is what we're encountering in today's society. I have an intense meeting with my boss. I'm worried about this relationship that I'm in, whatever it might be. So in a state of chronic stress that's there, chronic perceived stress, how does that affect our stress system and constantly keep it on inside of our body?
Yeah.
And so what's the impact of that for us?
Yeah. So if you think of stressors and you kind of stack stressors against each other, your stress response should sort of look like a peak and then a come down and a trough. But if you have many of those, and you have peak and peak and peak and peak, eventually your body will either have chronically high cortisol on the high end because it's adapting and thinking like, well, why come down? I might as well just stay elevated. And then on the other side of that, it can be elevated for so long that your adrenals think that your pituitary and hypothalamus are basically crying wolf. And the adrenals start to say, they're not fatigued. They're just a little lackadaisical. So you have chronic under response to stressors. And if you think about the, you know, how the system evolved and the way this would function ideally, is stress is a good thing in the short term, like we talked about. So when you have a stressor, when you're being chased by the tiger, there are a couple things you need to turn on and there are a couple things you need to turn off. You need to turn on energy mobilization. So you need to take cash out of the bank, turn it into cash to spend right now. So that means mobilizing energy from your muscle, from your fat stores, from your liver. Now that you've mobilized that energy, you need to get it to the muscles. You need to get it around the body where you need to use it. So you turn on the heart, you increase the blood pressure, you increase the heart rate, you know, getting that energy to your leg muscles in 2 seconds rather than five is the difference between life and death for this gazelle. You also need to turn on your immune system. Maybe this gazelle's bleeding out. He's being dragged through the dirt and has cuts all over him. He's probably going to need some extra help fighting off pathogens later when he recovers. You also need to turn on your brain. You need to be sharp. Your senses need to sharpen. You need to be able to think your way out of a situation. What you don't need to do is any long-term projects. You don't need reproduction. You don't need to grow. You don't need building. You don't need digestion right now. So you turn all of that off. But what happens if you're doing that over and over and over? So let's think about the things you turn on. You turn on energy mobilization. You take energy out of the muscles. So long term, now you're causing muscle wasting, muscle atrophy, muscle catabolism. And the medical term for low muscle mass is sarcopenia. And that's actually one of, and you wouldn't think this because you never hear about it, one of the more leading causes of death for elderly people. You now put that energy into the blood. So you have chronically elevated blood sugar. This means that you're going to have something called insulin resistance, be at higher risk for obesity and diabetes. And then the heart stuff, if you're elevating your blood pressure to 180 over 120 while you're being chased by the lion, that may save your life. If your blood pressure is 180 over 120 every time you walk into your office, you're going to have a chronically elevated stress-related high blood pressure. And that eventually remodels the heart and remodels the arteries, right? Our arteries become less elastic and less plastic. They get injured on the inside from, you know, high pressure going through the same tube. And the blood has to pump against this high pressure in the same size tubes. Sorry, the heart has to pump against the blood against the pressure of these same size tubes. So the heart now has to remodel itself, become more muscular, become more likely to suffer a lack of oxygen, like a heart attack sometime. When you turn on the immune system in the short term, that's great. In the long term, either you have an overactive immune system Or you do the opposite and you have such a low immune system that you can't fight off basic things. When you turn on the brain in the short term, that's great. In the long term, we remodel the brain. We run out of dopamine, which is, you know, it feels good. It's released in acute stress. Over a long period of stress, you run out of dopamine. Now you have a symptom called anhedonia, which is the joylessness we associate with depression. You destroy a part of your brain called the hippocampus, responsible for memory and learning. You shut down BDNF, which is brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which feeds our brain and makes new neurons. So you're inhibiting the production of new neurons in the hippocampus. You're pruning neurons. You're increasing the space between those synapses. And the hippocampus is literally losing weight. So, you know, memory problems, brain fog. There's another part of the brain, a brain structure called the amygdala, that's actually where fear lives. It's associated with fear. And unfortunately, high stress hormone, high cortisol, causes that area to grow. So now you're losing the memory part and you're increasing the fear part. Now you have anxiety. Now you have anxiety that's not even related to actual threat or actual stressors. You just have these primed fear loops, and that area becomes not only larger and gains weight, but more excitable. So there's all sorts of negative brain remodeling associated with chronic stress. And then if we talk about the things that we're shutting down in that acute stress response, the reproduction, the digestion, and the growth and repair, imagine shutting those things down long term. You have infertility and reproductive abnormalities, low testosterone in men, PCOS, amenorrhea in women, that's not ovulating, not having a cycle. You have thyroid issues, growth hormone issues. You have something called psychosocial dwarfism in children, which is when, you know, you look at the kid, you look at the kid's health, there's no nutritional deficiency, there's no organic body health problem. They're just under such extreme stress that they're years behind on their growth curve. And when you look at their growth hormone, in many cases, it's almost zero. There's a really interesting case a long time ago of a boy who had this psychosocial dwarfism and was living in like a, you know, a really abusive home. So was taken out, was put in a New York hospital and developed this relationship with a nurse, which was probably the only normal relationship he'd had with a caring adult that made him feel loved in his life. And his growth hormone within weeks went from zero to the growth hormone of a normal boy his age. The nurse went on vacation and his growth hormone went back down to zero. And she came back and it went back up immediately. So, you know, how much that boy was depositing calcium into his bones was literally dependent on him feeling safe and loved.
Where's the first place that you often start, knowing that it's highly personal? Mm-hmm. Where's the biggest bang for the buck that you start off with? Or is that based on their labs and conditions in life?
I love this question because it does empower the patient, because the first 12 things I do are not supplements and they're not drugs. And that it was sort of a hard thing for me to learn this and to recognize that these, like, what I thought of as like soft interventions are actually the most important interventions in HPAD. Because, you know, I did have this background of anesthesia. I love drugs. I love giving a drug and seeing it work and it being so reliable. And that does not work in HPA axis dysfunction if you haven't addressed other things. So it took me a while to get there. But after, you know, seeing repeated patients and realizing that you can throw all the supplements or drugs at a patient you want, if they have not addressed their stress, it's not going to stick. Nothing's going to work. So I think one of the first things they really have to address is perceived stress. And perceived stress is a tough one because, you know, like you said, with this woman's lifestyle, there's some things you can't change. You know, I can't change other people's stressors. I can help them change their response to stressors. And one of my favorite ways to do that is meditation. You can try to, you know, reduce somebody's stressors by telling them to do things like, you know, delegate tasks, get help. You can tell them to do things like stop looking at, you know, Facebook or Instagram or any social media. If it's bad for them, it can also be good for you. You know, you can also have positive inputs. If you scroll down my Instagram right now, it's like all pictures of otters and baby goats, and it's great for me.
and videos helps. Of you talking about favorite foods yeah. and things like that.
Yeah. And it actually releases oxytocin, which does reduce stress. You can give people strategies to help them release oxytocin, like increasing play and pleasure and sex and physical touch and social connection. You can, you know, tell people to stop getting in pointless arguments, direct them toward like a little bit of stoic philosophy, maybe go on a news fast, change the type of news you watch. And that can reduce your stressors a little bit, but most people's stressors are not going away. Most people's stressors are their job, their kids, their commute, and their, you know, their relationships. Some of those are a little bit changeable, but a lot of them are not going away. So you have to change the way that you respond to stressors. And the best way that I've found, and you mentioned this a little bit in my bio, is meditation. And I think particularly loving kindness meditation was sort of what I studied with that monk, Saigon Glassing. And they call it metta meditation in Buddhist tradition. And that type of meditation, you know, we were teaching it to patients to help them die well. These are patients that were in the palliative care part of the hospital. But that type of meditation, learning it, actually probably saved me from the ravages of HPA axis dysfunction, because I was in medical school. I was in my, you know, fourth year of medical school. I was getting burned out. And that was probably, that probably turned things around for me and allowed me to be a much better doctor, ultimately, because you can't be a decent doctor if your own body is broken.
And yet, I mean, I have so many doctors in my family and they're always running so hardcore. Yeah. And they're doing that. What can you remember when you first encountered this practice of this loving kindness meditation, this this monk? What were some of the first signs that you saw in your body, changes or the way that you would perceive things? Like, what did you notice when you first started to get into the meditation?
Yeah, I noticed that I just had a lot more sort of freedom of my choice and how to respond to situations that would have kind of like set me off before. I just had a little bit more space around that decision of how I'm going to respond.
And I know we were chatting a little bit before the podcast started, and I was asking you if you had your own hero's journey when it came to health, and you were like, no, I kind of like just have always been into this and yeah. I would read about it on my downtime. But did you notice anything physiologically for yourself? So in addition to how you responded to things, would you notice any shifts in your body, or how you would did you notice any physical changes in your body?
I do. I do notice signs of decreased inflammation if I'm on a meditation program and I'm meditating well. I really like a program, everybody should check it out, by Emily Fletcher, who came and presented to us, called Ziva. And when I'm really consistent with that, I do notice decreased signs of inflammation. So I had a back injury in the OR a long time ago and had pain for quite a long time, at least like 2 years of kind of like 7 every day. And pain's a sign of system-wide inflammation. Pain is one of the classic herald signs of inflammation. And my pain goes down if I'm meditating daily. I notice kind of other inflammatory signs in my body change. Just, you know, the way your skin looks, where you carry fat, those things change with meditation, I think.
You know, there's this article on, it was all over the internet the other day, but it was basically talking about some recent studies that have come out about how powerful honey is when compared to traditional cold medication for kids, mm-hmm. kids above the age of 1. Mm-hmm. That honey works better than placebo and works better than cough syrup and everything else that's out there. And it was like a definitive thing. The individuals that were sharing this research, I think, was NIH funded. And it made me think that, going back to this comment that you made earlier, that soft interventions that we often so overlook them because we're waiting for the magic pill or the magic bullet that's out there. What's another example, separate from meditation, what's another example of what would be considered traditionally as a soft intervention that actually is fundamentally important to HPA, HPAD?
Yeah, so we've talked a little bit about circadian dysfunction, either that flattened daily rhythm or it being inversed or something being a little weird about it. And the best thing you can do is change your exposure to light. So that seems like a super soft intervention. But the way that our hypothalamus senses what time of day it is, or the way that our brain senses what type of day it is the light hits our retina The retina communicates back through the optic nerve straight to the hypothalamus, to a part called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. And then that sets our circadian clock. So in the daytime, we associate bright daylight rays, which have a lot of blue tones in them.
Like this fake studio that makes it look like their day.
So they have a lot of blue tones in them. So our brain associates that with day. During the night, typically there are a lot more orange tones in the light and the light's lower. Our brain associates that with night. Our brain associates full darkness with complete night. So one of the most simple things you can do for people with circadian dysfunction or even high cortisol is give them blue light blocking glasses and tell them to, at some point in the morning hours, especially if they're having a problem getting that good, mounting that good cortisol peak in the morning, you want them to get bright daylight, maybe in the even first thing in the morning, at least a half an hour of bright daylight in their eyes. They don't have to be outside. They could be by a window. But you want that bright daylight in their eyes. If they can't get it, you want them to get a full spectrum light box and just sit in front of it. And then you get them these blue light blocking glasses, which I have and my boyfriend thinks are very cool. and wear them after dark. And there are two flavors. You know, you can
Does he have his own pair?
No. Yeah, I don't think he would ever. So you can get two flavors. You can get the ones that have clear lenses that you don't look so dorky, and you can wear those sort of just after the sun sets. Maybe you're still at work. Maybe, you know, you're out and about. You don't want to go full dweeb yet. But then if it's getting later, especially if you're working on a computer screen, which are classic for blue light rays, TVs emit a lot of blue light, even overhead lights emit blue light, but devices especially, if you're working on a device, if you're watching a TV, absolutely use like the completely orange blue blockers.
We forget how simple things like light impact us. I was at my girlfriend's house one time pretty early on, and she was always talking about like at night, she gets this like second wind. And of course, everybody's different and their patterns and their cortisol levels and that sort of thing. And I remember her going into her bathroom to like wash her face and get ready for bed. And her lights were like office, like studio level bright in the bathroom. And I was like, babe, let's try something. You know, I just had gotten her this Juve light that was in the bedroom. I was like, just use that and like it'll shine enough into the bathroom so that you can see. And just changing from going from turning the typical bathroom lights on, which were so bright at night. Mm-hmm. We'd get back at 10 p.m. from a dinner. She'd be tired on the ride back over in our Uber. We'd get home. She'd go in the bathroom. She'd come back. She's like, I'm up. I want to like go read something, do something, whatever it might be. And just switching to just doing the orange light, because I didn't think that she was going to wear the glasses at the time.
Yeah.
And having that shine in and brush her teeth, wash her face, do everything. I could see how much that would just have her relax a little bit more and get ready for winding down and get ready for bed.
Yep. And then diet's huge. I mean, diet's huge for everything, but if you think of inflammation as one of the main causes of HPAD, having an anti-inflammatory diet is key. And then having a nutrient-dense diet is key because you can be too low on nutrients that your adrenal glands need to do their job. You can be low on, you know, B vitamins. They need the B vitamins. They need a lot of vitamin C more than any other place in the body. They use more vitamin C.
Before we go to the next one, from what I was reading from some of the work you were mentioning about Chris Kresser and having done his program, and you had sent us some interesting articles that he had put out there on HPAD. One of the things that it seemed, if I want to, you know, try to get this right, but I might have gotten it completely wrong, so please correct me. There's also this thing where sometimes people think that the immediate thing to do is to focus on their diet. Not that diet isn't important, it's so key, but often a lot of the people, men and women that you see, their diet is perfect, right? They're eating low carb, they're doing these things, but their blood sugar can still be affected because their stress levels.
Exactly. So stress hormones, the class that cortisol is in, are called glucocorticoids. So it tells you right there in the name, gluco. These hormones affect the blood sugar system and affect blood sugar trafficking. So people can be eating perfectly and eating in a way that we would tell somebody with prediabetes to eat, which is lower on carb count, but you know, still have dysregulation of their blood sugar system even more because they're so stressed out. But I would say for people with HPA axis dysfunction, they oftentimes need to not be so low carb. Sometimes you see them developing HPA axis dysfunction after a long time on a super low carb diet. And sometimes they do need to optimize protein intake definitely. So they need to be higher on protein count. But eating some carbs and especially eating those carbs at night tends to help with HPAD.
One of the things you were mentioning about the archetype of the patient that came to you in New York is also working out. You know, we think of working out as being such an important factor. It is, and I'm sure you're going to get to that in a second. But let's go towards this modern trend of CrossFit and other aspects. Every person is different, but how is more maybe not better when it comes to the HPA axis?
Yeah, more is not always better, especially with high intensity cardio. And these like these type A people, like this patient I talked about, love high intensity cardio. They love CrossFit and they love high intensity cardio. And you know, we know from studies of reproductive age men that these guys who love long distance running, run like 20 miles a day, they have testosterone that looks like an 11-year-old boy. And they have lower sperm counts. And that's mediated through the HPA axis. That's mediated through the stress hormone system. We know what's, you know, causing that suppression of the gonadal production of hormone. So oftentimes when somebody has HPAD, they need to pull back on exercise. They need to pull back particularly on high-intensity exercise and high-intensity cardio. So, you know, if they're really struggling with HPAD, a lot of times at first you only want them to be doing some walking, maybe some swimming. Chris Kresser swears by Tai Chi and Qigong. I've never done them myself, but they seem like really good interventions because you're getting sort of like a little bit of that stress reduction and mindfulness and a little bit of movement. You don't want somebody to be completely sedentary. You do want them to be moving, but you know, they've withdrawn so much from their adrenal bank account that they need to start putting deposits in before they have any energy to work out. And you'll often see these people not recovering well. So you can tell that their adrenals aren't liking that level of exercise because they're having what we call post-exertional myalgia or post-exertional fatigue, where their muscles are hurting more than a couple days after their workout, or they are so wiped out they have to go straight to sleep after a workout. So you need to escalate these people back slowly back with a little bit of movement. As they begin to recover, they can do a little bit more, but that's sort of a dangerous stage because a lot of these people are, to some extent, at least sort of emotionally addicted to that high intensity exercise. So you have to make sure they don't jump right back in too quickly and sort of build up, put more deposits into that bank account before they can make big withdrawals again.
And you can still do resistance training without it being CrossFit.
Yeah.
You know, there's different programs that are out there that are more chill, but you can still do some resistance training.
Of course. And
weights.
I love yoga. Certain types of Pilates are a little bit more mellow.
My next guest, Dr. Amy Shah, is a double board certified medical doctor and wellness expert specializing in allergy, immunology, hormone, and gut health. She's also the author of I'm So Effing Tired, a proven plan to beat burnout, boost your energy, and reclaim your life. Dr. Shah shares her personal story of running on empty, raising two kids, and studying for her medical boards while trying to build a thriving practice. She was overtired, overworked, and overexhausted. She was also gaining weight inexplicably. She was irritable all the time, and her energy was non-existent. She couldn't figure out what was wrong, and she felt too tired to even find out. Let's listen in as Dr. Shah talks to us about the wake-up call she needed to make big changes in her life. Let's set the stage with a little bit of a hero's journey and talk about how did you get into this space and teaching people? You kind of had like a pretty big moment in your life that turned things around. Would love for you to set the stage. And if you want to share that story, it'd be great.
Yeah. Here's the thing. I think so many of us can relate to feeling like your mind is going at a million miles per hour all the time. So I was a young doctor with two young children, and I had a practice. And they said to me, this is your practice. You go for it. You know, we'll be your partners and you make it your own. And then I had these young children who were literally dependent on me for everything. And then I had my second board certification exam coming up, which meant that I'm double board certified. And each time you get board certification, you also have to pass this exam a few months later. And it's very, very rigorous. And, you know, all of my life, I've put a lot of pressure on myself. And I think all of us, you know, we wear our hard work and our burnout as a badge of honor. And I was there. I was not sleeping. I was working crazy hours. I would come home, I'd spend time with the kids, and then I would study late at night. And there was just no time for, you know, any of the things that I enjoyed doing, because that would be, you know, lazy, or that means that I'm not unmotivated. That means that I wasn't really doing what I was supposed to do.
Where, can I ask, yeah, just because, you know, we come from a similar South, yeah, Asian background, yeah, actually from, you know, similar Gujarati, yeah, backgrounds and everything. Are your parents doctors? Was, yeah, it just, I mean, obviously a lot of immigrants have just this incredible work ethic, as, yeah, they had to, you know, they had to sort of sacrifice their health and bodies to make the life for their kids that they needed to. Were your parents doctors, or did you see that modeled kind of growing up?
Absolutely. My dad was not a doctor. He was an engineer. But he was the hardest working person, you know, ever. Very immigrant, similar to many immigrants. And he was the one who was advising me. He said, don't worry, do this all. We'll help you as much as we can. Because in his eyes, he felt like we should all be working as hard as we can. And he's an amazing person and such a hard worker. But for me, that was creating a sense of I need to work even harder to make all of these things happen for me. So my mind was always going at a million miles per hour. One day, I knew I was burned out, but I didn't know, I couldn't pause, because then everything would fall apart in my eyes. So one day my partners asked if we could do a meeting after work at 5. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, I have to pick up my kids shortly thereafter. But I didn't have the courage to even say that, because I thought, well, what are they going to think of me as a young doctor? Maybe they're going to think I'm not as committed or whatever. So I said, sure, I'll stay. And then I thought to myself, okay, I'll just rush out and I'll go get them and everything will be fine, because the center closed at 6. And I knew that it would be such an embarrassment if I showed up there at later than 6, because they would have to keep it open for me. So I sat there during the meeting and I can't even concentrate on what they're saying, because in my mind, I'm like calculating how many minutes it's going to take me to do this.
Two places at once.
Yeah. And, you know, we've all been there where our minds cannot even focus on the task at hand. And when you're in a burnout state, you're almost like disconnected from your body. So it's not just fatigue. It's also this disconnect. And so then as soon as the meeting was over, of course, it went way over and I didn't have the guts to say that I needed to leave. So I ran to the car and I'm rushing. And you know, when you're driving and you're making these split second decisions, and I was making a turn into the center's parking lot, or right before the center's parking lot, and I got into this huge accident. I was making a left and there's someone who's coming straight. And it wasn't really my fault, per se, but I did probably make a very quick left without seeing that person coming super fast. So that was the first time in my life I had ever seen all of the airbags in the entire car, you know, side, front. And I felt like I was spinning for hours, but really it was minutes. It was a big intersection. And then as soon as I hit something, I opened the door, and the first thing I did, I had like glass and blood and everywhere. And the first thing I did is like, I started running towards the center, because I said, oh my God, they're like, it's 6 now, and they're going to be judging me for being late. I literally was running off the scene of this life-threatening accident to try to get the kids before it was too late, and that I was so worried about what she would think of me if I showed up late. And that was really the state of my life at that point. It was like there was no room for error. And that big error for me was such a great pause for about a week, where I kind of had to step back and say, what am I doing? What do I really want? How do I really want my life to look like? And why am I spending so much time doing all these things, yet feeling exhausted and unmotivated and short and having all these symptoms that I never had before, GI symptoms, anxiety symptoms, sleep symptoms. So that's when my whole journey started. That's how I start the book. And this is how my whole journey into wellness started, because my Western medicine training, I was a nutrition major in college. I, you know, did internal medicine. Then I did immunology, allergy. Nothing in my whole training was preparing me to help myself. And I know at that point, I knew that there were so many other people in that same place. And so I really dug deep into this topic, and that's where I got some solutions. And I know I heard so much about like mental solutions. Oh, do meditation or do this training to help you with burnout. But I didn't see anyone really talking about mind-body solutions. And so that's where I went with this.
It's first of all, were you okay? You said blood in the accident. Were you okay with it? Was the other person okay?
So yes. So luckily there was no major, I was sore and I had cuts and bruises. And of course the car was completely totaled, but everybody came out of it alive. So
that's good. Knock on wood.
Yeah.
You know, I think moments like that are a big wake up call, as they were. And it's kind of like, if you think about the classic sort of arc of the hero's journey, whether you're ready for the adventure or you get thrusted into it, and often most of us get thrusted into it,
yeah,
it'll just send you along. So you got thrusted on this journey. And one of the things, I don't know if I'm jumping too far ahead, but one of the things you did was you went to your doctors at the time, right? Because doctors have doctors.
Yeah.
And you said, basically, like, what's wrong with me?
Yeah. First of all, I didn't have a doctor, because doctors don't have doctors. But I said, maybe I'm missing something, because fatigue, as you know, can have many medical causes. Iron deficiency, B12, you know, there's thyroid. There's a million medical diagnoses that could lead to fatigue. So I thought, well, maybe I'm just not able to treat myself. So I actually found super smart colleagues that were willing to just, you know, run some tests on me and check what maybe I was missing. And I was embarrassed, because when the tests came back, they all said, oh, you're normal. Like, everything is within normal limits. And I kind of felt like, well, I feel embarrassed now. Like, I asked them to do these tests and nothing came up. So I must be. And they said, oh, you know, you're busy. You're mom. You're getting older. And it's like that. You just go back home and you're like, okay, well, there's really, maybe it's all in my head. And that's when I really started to do the nutritional part of it, the changing of the gut health and looking into how does this all relate to burnout. And that's how my journey started. And now I see so many people saying the same thing to me. Like, you know, I went to my doctor, either they found something, we fixed it, and I'm still tired, or there's nothing that they could find, or things were within normal limits. Even I didn't realize back then that even today, 2021, we really don't have the ability to check for burnout, to check for causes of fatigue that aren't from an organ being severely injured or broken. So that's the problem, as you know.
Yeah. I want to shift a little bit into the psychobiology piece and the mindset piece by connecting it back to your original story. You were chatting earlier when we started this conversation about the guilt that you were filled with, right? You were in the meeting with your other partners that were there in the medical practice, and there was this request to stay later, and there was this guilt and this feeling of being pulled in two different directions. You were speeding on your way over to get your kids, and the guilt of what you said specifically, you know, what will they think if I'm late?
Yeah.
And there's the accident component that you got into, and then immediately after checking that everybody's okay, including yourself, the running over in that direction to get your kids, because also the feeling of guilt. Tell me a little bit more, as you've been sharing your own journey as both a physician, a mom, a woman who's been open about what the things she's gone through, including that story that we just shared. What have been the other messages that you've been getting on the topic of guilt from people that follow you and follow your work?
Absolutely. Whenever I talk about boundaries, it's a hot topic. It's a hot topic for moms, for women, for people just in general, because I think we feel a lot of guilt when our boundaries are really low and we are pulled in many different directions because we allow ourselves to be pulled in so many different directions. And as soon as you start putting up firm boundaries, there's going to be a little pushback. There's going to be people who don't like it. But eventually they will learn and you will flourish from having those. And so I really talk about energy management and putting up those boundaries for your own personal energy as something that is something I learned the hard way. And what I hope that people can learn from this book is not just, yeah, change your diet, change what you eat, when you eat, but also really change the way you manage your mind and how you manage your mind energy. Do you really need to have every notification on your phone? Do you really need to watch all the news to be updated all the time? Do you really need to let everyone in to your energy? Do you need to give everyone your energy? That is a piece that I think can be transformative.
What's an example of a boundary that you very easily set today that 7 years ago, 5 years ago, yeah, 10 years ago, it would have been, you would have ruminated on it. Like, should I do it? Should I not? You have the gut feeling that you want to set a boundary right there, but you would have been like, I don't know. What will people think of me? Can you think of anything like that that you regularly do today?
So many things I regularly do today are boundaries, and they're kind boundaries. I feel like boundaries is such a like negative term, like, oh, this person has so many boundaries. No, it's actually a really positive thing because you are spreading a positive message by some of the, like some of my boundaries are positive boundaries. So for example, I've told, maybe not even verbally, but just by experience, I don't answer my phone, texts or emails after a certain hour, like 2 to 3 hours before bed, it's done for me. So if you text me at 10 p.m., I will not text you back till the next morning. And if you want to have a conversation with me about, you know, something that's going on, and unless it's an emergency, I won't take it until the next day, right? So having that boundary on your energy, because I need, what I learned is if I go to sleep after having a very activating conversation, email, text, exchange, whatever, I cannot sleep because I'm focusing on that, you know, you're ruminating on what you just did, or it's upsetting, or it's really exciting, or whatever it is. So that was one really clear boundary. Another clear boundary is that I don't compromise on my basics. So my basics are like sleep, sunlight, movement, right? So if I create a life that always includes those things and those are non-negotiables for me, then they will happen. Otherwise, you feel guilty all the time for doing all those things because you didn't build it into your life and you didn't set a boundary around it. It's like as important as an appointment, you know, to do those things for yourself. There's so many. When I intermittent fast, when I do the circadian fasting, I follow that on the weekdays, especially very aggressively, and I try to stick with it. And so that means that once in a while, I will just be having tea when I'm sitting with someone, or it means that I am, you know, not going to go to that late night girls' dinner on a weekday because for me, I've protected that time. So really, putting up boundaries has been so transformative for me, but they're not mean. It's not like I always thought of boundaries as this thing that I wasn't supposed to do because that would be so mean and I have to be nice and giving to everyone. But I realized that these kind of boundaries are very, very kind to myself. And by being kind to myself, I can be so much better to everyone else.
Yeah. And also too, I think on the topic of mean is that people will interpret things in all sorts of different ways. Their interpretation is their experience, right? And they're allowed to have their experience if they decide that something's mean or something's not. But you are coming from a place of you knowing your own intent, right?
Yeah.
And the rest can be clarified through conversation. If somebody has an issue, they bring it up and then you can discuss. I think one layer to add into the boundaries that I think is so key is that, you know, the Instagram meme right now is, you know, get rid of toxic people in your life, other stuff. And I've said this on multiple interviews, but even once to end, it's like end is a really great word to add. And also see what draws you to those folks in the first place. Also see where you've been complicit in allowing them to do the things that are there. Usually when I hear the term, people are taking advantage of me, it's like, I'm agreeing to do a bunch of shit that I don't want to do.
Yeah.
And if we don't see that aspect of it, we can get rid of one person, or we can set a firm boundary with our family or whatever it might be. And then it just shows up again at work because we haven't seen how we are part of it. So it's both of those things in the full circle of it is we need to know, why am I being driven towards that? Why, you know, when I was a kid growing up, everybody said you should be a good little girl, or you should do this thing, or you should be this type of boy, or only, you know, angry people say this, and we unwind those patterns so that we can live the way that we want to live and show up in the world the way that we want to show up in the world.
I love that. I think, you know, having self-reflection is a huge part of this journey of burnout, of just being happy. Because if you're not reflecting on yourself and how can you improve yourself, everything is always going to be broken. You know, everything around you will always be broken because you cannot expect the world to work the way you want it to work without working on yourself first.
And I think there's another layer to the side of burnout, which is that, I mean, would you say it's, I can't imagine that you as an Ivy League doctor and all your sort of accolades and double board certified and all that beautiful things, you had to have gone through burnout in that process. So when you look at this lens of everything that you achieved, you wouldn't be the person who you are, the book, the other stuff. How do you think of that in that component? I think that the reason that I'm asking this question, as you can imagine, is that there's so much attention on these conversations of self-care and setting up the boundaries and the other stuff. And I'm looking at you and I'd love to see how you look at your full journey through that lens.
But Drew, I think it's actually helping you. The whole point is not to hinder you from doing what you want to do. It's actually helping you, because if you're not burned out, you are in your element. You are doing the work that you're supposed to be doing in an attentive and energetic and a connected way. And the way I think about it is that these are not things that are going to like take you away from your goals. It's actually things that are going to push you towards your goals because you need sustained. Things don't happen overnight. You and I both know that it takes years for us to have sustained effort to create anything, a book, a business, a life, a family. And that requires the work, this work that we're talking about. So I would argue that we'll get further and we'll continue to get further. When I started to do the work on myself, that's when things started to change. That's when I was able to create a life that I wanted. And I think that's true for so many people.
Maybe you've seen yourself in Dr. Shah's story. And maybe just like her, you've been told by family and friends and possibly even doctors that there's nothing to be done about it, except perhaps quitting your job or going on an extended vacation from your life, which in all likelihood is not really possible. Women in particular are suffering from an epidemic of fatigue and burnout. So many women feel alone in their inability to manage all of their personal and professional demands. Many assume their fatigue is just normal and an inevitable part of life, but it's not normal at all. I hope that after listening to this episode, you feel empowered to take the necessary steps to regain your lost energy and reclaim your life through a conscious daily commitment to radical self-care. Thanks for tuning into this mini episode of the Drew Pro Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, share it with someone who's burnt out, who might be looking for a life raft, and this mini episode could change their life. I'll see you again next week.